and I'm Jill, and I live here as well. So I wanted to talk about, we're having a workshop on wonder, so I wanted to talk about curiosity. And I'll come at it first from a neuroscience viewpoint, and then a religious viewpoint, and then from your viewpoint, I hope. So in the first part of the talk comes from a woman named Kelly McGonigal, who's she's one of those people that's just everything. She's a psychologist. She teaches yoga. She knows so much, and it does it so well that you can also find her everywhere, from Stanford, where she works, to Good Morning America. So she's just kind of wide-ranging. And the first part of this is pretty much paraphrased from one of her talks, which you can find on YouTube, which is called, which I did not write down. I should not do that before getting in front of a bunch of people. It's called What Science Can Teach Us About Practice. Okay, and so neuroscience is interesting right now in this day and age that we live in, because about 2002, there was a guy at the University of Wisconsin named Richard Davidson, and he had access to all these machines. And they pretty much could see where happiness came from and empathy came from. And they can't yet read what we're thinking, but they kind of can look at how we're thinking. And so he did this little study on, he wanted to make a bell curve for what happiness and empathy might look like. So he made a normal bell curve, and then somebody said, you know, the Dalai Lama is really interested in science. Maybe you could borrow some of his monks. So he did this. So he got, I believe it was like 4 months, maybe it was more, and then hooked them up to the machines. So the possibilities for happiness kind of look like this, and we're generally up here, and there's some really happy people out here. And what happened was, when he hooked up the monks, every one of those monks was outside on the far end of the bell curve of happiness, compassion, recognizing other people's emotions. And so a couple of years later, he had an $11 million research facility, and now the interest that science has in what we're doing here is enormous. There's research centers dedicated to this all over the world: Stanford, Yale, Toronto, and Montreal both have huge centers. Recently, the UC Davis just stole our guy from Stanford with a $20 million center. I mean, there's a lot going on with this stuff. So what they're finding is one thing is the brain has a default state, and that a default state is that when we're all at rest, you know, when we're doing nothing, what generally happens is the hippocampus, the prefrontal cortex, become active, and we start, the memory wakes up, and the mind turns generally towards the past, and then also forward towards planning, and it starts creating alternate realities. Language really wakes up, and we've got this internal narrative going on. And so for modern human beings, that's kind of our normal restful state. The Buddha also called that dukkha, and we generally call that suffering, because sooner or later, running these alternate scenarios over and over again usually involves unpleasant situations. So science has figured that out. It's not a real surprise to us. So far, they found out that we live in samsara. That's the normal default state of the brain. So someone asks, is there a way to experience being human without this narrative? You know, which is a familiar question. I think we all came here with that same question in mind. And what they discovered in researching all these people, that there's only one group of humans that can't actually have a normal default state without this narrative. And that group was experienced meditators. Musicians were real close. But experienced meditators are the only group known so far that they can have a default state without the narrative. And let's see, I wrote down with experienced meditators, what did I write down? I wrote down somatic sensory areas, the brain becomes active, which means we're feeling the body more. We can reach a state where rather than talking about what's going on around it, we're simply experiencing it. We're feeling our bodies. Our attention is a little more activated. And let me switch out of ours, because they're talking about highly advanced practitioners. I've not been road tested yet. but their attention is activated, and there's a real difference. There's an experiential system of brain activity, and there's an evaluated system where we're experiencing something and then we think about it. And they discovered that somehow experienced meditators are decoupling experience from evaluation. So it's kind of probably not entirely new, and it may be connected with our more modern intellectual life, the skill, and I suspect may go back. At one time, we were hunter-gatherers, and if you've ever hunted or if you've ever gathered forage for food that you really needed to eat, not just because it was fun, is you notice there's this awareness of possibilities that are out there. Suddenly the whole world becomes open in a way that you're just going around being aware of what might happen. If you try and focus your attention on any one thing, you're going to miss what happens over there. You may miss a berry, you may miss a deer. The second thing that happens is that you begin to feel connected to the things that are growing and arising out of the earth. And you have this awareness, and you shift from seeing animals and plants from separate beings to being part of you. And this is kind of a natural thing that happens when we must get our sustenance from the earth. As we've separated from that and come up with ways of getting it by making long-term plans, these thoughts and scenarios come up more often, and that seems to be what may be the problem that we're dealing with now. So back to science in Montreal, they wanted to look at what meditators were doing, and they noticed that they figured out scientifically that you can't avoid pain, but suffering is optional. This was another major advance in science in the early 2000s. Again, something we're all familiar with. So in Montreal, what they did was they hooked people up to a heat band, and they turned that up until it really hurt, and they watched what was going on in people's mind. And they had three groups, just people who had never meditated, intermediate meditators, and people that had a long-term meditation practice that made it in this experience group. And they found that what they were doing, we'll call them normal people, they didn't like the pain very much at all. And they were the first ones to press this button in their hand that let them shut it off. The second group could take more pain. But they looked at what was going on in their brains, and they found that they learned the skill to shut the limbic system down, that they could limit the pain for a while and they could block it. But then they noticed the experience group, they were really taking a lot of pain, and they needed more pain to even get a reaction out of these people. And they looked at what they were doing, and they were not shutting the limbic system down. What they were doing is they were curious about it, and they were interacting it. And in fact, they were actually feeling more actual pain, but there was much less of a narrative about it. And so meditation will actually increase your tolerance for pain, and how you go about it makes a huge difference. So what marked the difference between the experience group and the intermediate group was the experience group were curious about it. They wanted to know what was going on. They wanted to know what it felt like to be in pain. And that curiosity helped them. So, in Wake Forest, they ran an emotional pain study, and they showed these evocative images of really, really horrible things, and they wanted to see what happened in people's brains. And they found the same things. New meditators deactivated the amygdala, and they deactivated the actual direct experience. So actually, when we first get started, the first skill we get is the way to kind of shut all this stuff off. But they found that long-term meditators were able to achieve lower levels of distress, and they deactivated the areas of brain associated with inner commentary. And they focused on the experience itself rather than the commentary. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Okay. A depression study looked at MBSR and depressed people, and what they did was sad images. And they were looking at the insula, which is areas of the brain that can control attention and emotions. And they noticed that untrained people, when exposed to distress, start creating stories about it. But meditators focus on the experience of their own emotions, and then they process them as they arise. And they noticed that the greater the subjects activated their insula, which means they're processing these emotions, the more they reduced their depression. And so the sad images could even actually help them. Let's skip all that because I'm going too long. Okay, so what science is finding is there's two kinds of mindfulness. One that deactivates the amygdala, the immediate response, and it suppresses feelings. And there's a second one that deactivates the internal monologue and attends to the experience. So when something goes wrong, I'm right here. I'm right here with it, rather than my other choice is something goes wrong and I can just kind of block. I'm calm. I'm not going to panic. I'm good. And those are the two types. I believe in my experience that this is a necessary process. We come in here. Generally, we don't go sit and face a wall for 40 minutes because life is really great. There's usually something driving us in this room, something that we just can't take anymore. There's some kind of feeling that we've got to do something with. And so we begin by getting a handle on it, turning it down, and then we pull it back out. You know, we're on our journey, and we start learning how to process things. So while science is looking at variables generally, and it's usually an either-or thing, it's probably with us a process that's constantly going on. Okay, let me breathe. Okay. So it's important to recognize that we're on this journey, and there's a stage one that requires us to move into a non-default kind of mindfulness. That doesn't make any sense at all, does it? Okay. Where we kind of get a handle on what's going on, and we're going to do something different. That different thing we do is what causes what we call practice. And so we're generally going to stop doing what we were doing, and we're going to try something new. And that generally feels like we're just slogging through mud. We're not doing what we were going to do, but we're doing something unfamiliar. And so it just kind of feels like we're on a new road. And what we're actually doing, the neuroscience is now knows, is we're rewiring the brain, where we're taking default neural connections, we're uncoupling those, and then we're reconnecting those. And so it's important to both uncouple those and recouple them in a new way. Curiosity seems to be what that difference is. And it seems to me to be marked by a feeling of lightness, vibrancy, maybe a little more color, and to me, it seems to have an actual texture, that the world appears to be a little different as I'm using different parts of my mind. The growth is not necessarily linear. It's not like, you know, once for a while we're in dukkha, and then we start shutting things down, and then finally we reach a point where it's just we know how to deal with everything. It actually goes kind of back and forth. And I can remember at one point in my life I was meditating, things seemed to be going well, and then I reached a point where my marriage came to an end. And there was a huge amount of stress and opposition. All of a sudden, I had to do my life a completely different way. Every action required something different. And the result was kind of, was a going back to this rigid, you know, keeping a handle on things. This was the largest, you know, what I didn't expect is this would be the most difficult emotional situation of my life. It was a huge failure, and something rose up that even though I knew I was going to a better place, the failure was more than I could bear. So I got right. So I started going to the San Francisco Zen Center every Saturday and working with a teacher, and I was really working hard at my practice. And the world seemed to, and everything felt like I knew all this stuff about curiosity. You know, I really felt like I was doing it. And then one day I came home from Sishin, I had this kind of mindfulness, this rigid mindfulness, and I really felt like I was there. And then I noticed that I came home and I was going around and I felt like I was really on it. And then I suddenly had this realization that I knew where socks went, and they were behind the washing machine. I was looking for a sock, and I just had this epiphany that the sock was there. I looked behind the sock. There was a slanted wall here, and as my head went down, I just hit a light that was mounted on the wall. It was right in front of me. Next thing I know, blood everywhere. I've got to wake up the neighbors and go to the emergency room. So that kind of mindfulness, it sure seemed like it was real at the time, but it actually took a trip to the hospital to go, maybe I need to open up. Maybe the fact that I know everything is not actually right. 4 months later, you know, emotionally, I was still just holding on. I was okay. I was going to survive. A spring day arose, and I couldn't take it anymore. I just couldn't take that pain. And I remember just one morning, I was having my coffee like I did every day, and I just kind of accepted this total failure. And the moment I did, and then I thought, I was amazed that I was alive, you know, because I didn't know I could experience this much pain and not kill myself. But I'm like, I'm experiencing pain past the point of what I imagine I would live with, and I'm going to go to work is what I'm going to do about it. But I looked up, and I could see these trees. I could see this world in the midst of this sadness that just seemed to have a new color, a new vibrancy, and there was this sudden awareness that came that I really have no idea where all this came from, where anything's going, what's happening, and there was this just wonder and fascination with that pain even, that it was, and suddenly it became bearable, it became part of me, and I went and got to work and eventually arrived here. So I'm gonna have, if I'm gonna give you any time, I'm gonna have to run through the rest. But there's a koan that I picked up about that time, and I've carried it with me ever since. And like what often happens, the way most koans begin, it begins with two Zen teachers meet. Okay, one is carrying his bags, and the other one asks him, "Where are you going?" "I'm going on a pilgrimage," the other teacher responds. "What's the purpose of the pilgrimage?" asks the first teacher. I don't know," he responds. "Ah," replies the first teacher, "not knowing is most intimate." And that feeling of intimacy with the world is, I think, when we're looking for wonder, that's the greatest sign, that when we experience this quiet, intimacy to know it's hard to know when we're really curious, but it makes all the difference. The science has redefined the definition of mindfulness. Originally in the 90s, it was the ability to concentrate or pay attention and the ability to focus that attention on the present moment. What all these studies have revealed is that they can't really tell a difference with meditators unless they add one more phrase. And the third requirement of a mindful state of mind nowadays is being curious. Do I have anything? Yeah. And then as far as your experience, I'll just add one more Zen story. And this happened at the San Francisco Zen Center in the 70s. And it happened over coffee. And a woman said to Shunryu Suzuki that it was difficult to mix in with being a housewife. And she felt she was trying to climb a ladder, but for every step up she would go down too. Forget the ladder, Suzuki told her. In Zen, everything is right here on the ground. So let's come down from my talk, which I may have overdone because I was scared. And what do you think?
Thank you, Joe. I like the bell curve description, and that people that meditate look like they're outside the bell curve, so they're kind of the crazy people outside the bell curve. Is that partly what you're saying?
They could. I haven't read that, but yeah, nobody looked at whether or not they were sane. Well, no. The study, the way it was pointed out is they say that the only people who experience that kind of activity, other than those who are insane. But I'm not sure how good the testing was done on these monks.
And a few artists, maybe.
What's that?
And a few artists here.
Yeah.
I was especially intrigued with your mentioning of the hunter-gatherers, mm-hmm. because that's something I've been thinking about this last year, that what we do. It seems bizarre to come and sit and look at a wall. I thought it's very ancient that's what probably, like you said, these studies, most of humankind, that's what we've done the majority of our time. That's our default, is to be not just, like you say, being blank, but looking, in a real quiet, sustained, peaceful way at everything that surrounds us. And it's not just about being calm or feeling good. There's a real active, engaged element of a subtle seeking, right? But not trying to get things out, but you're always being aware. Like we said, if you're focusing on, I'm going to get a deer, you'll miss the berry. I'm intrigued by that. The right word, it's not analogy, but correspondence between Zazen and being a hunter-gatherer, which is what, 99.9% of our time on this planet, we're hunter-gatherers. So I like that I sit down and I'm hunting and gathering.
I think for them, their connection with the world is just so immediate. When you're walking around, I mean, berries, of course, are great. They're awesome, but they're not there most of the time. And so going around and looking at the world, and you're looking, you're aware, and then something comes in. Maybe It's not something you've seen before, and you have to ask this. Is this, you know, it's right in your hand, and you're going to eat it, and you might live, you might die, but you're like, is this me? Because it's going to become me, and the separation between eating like that, which is normal for them, is...
And the whole connection with eating, too, and making it a part of it.
Yeah.
Eating is such a huge element if you're, you know, you don't have all these other things happening that we do most of the time.
Yeah, and each meal may be the last one you ever eat. It's awesome. Should be beautiful. Emily.
Well, the thinking that we know could be maybe changed if we ask the question, investigate, is that the curiosity? Instead of thinking we know, to just ask, see if we know.
Yeah, and we'll go more into this afternoon, but the whole idea that this narrative has convinced us that thoughts are words. And yet our minds are composed of whole of three major thinking systems divided into two parts. So there's this whole cosmos of thinking going on in our mind. And the feeling of wonder when you let go and there are no words anymore and you're listening to the thought in your the whole range of thought in your body. So, realizing that we already know, and that's when we get that moment where we already know something.
I experience lots of different kinds of curiosity mm-hmm. and different kinds of investigation. Yeah. And some of them are much more aggressive. Got to figure this out.
Yeah.
Got to categorize what and put things into causal relationships. This caused this, and which then caused this, and had these factors. You know, it's like scientist investigation. But I don't know if that's the only kind. You know, right? Mm-hmm. The curiosity that sounds like you're connecting to mindfulness. And I don't mean to speak for everybody. It's just, for me, it's kind of, it's almost more like ongoing surprise. Because there's this, it's more of a nonverbal curiosity. It's like, whoa. Mm-hmm. You know, you see color, you know, or you feel cold, or you feel warmth, or there's wind, or there's a bird, you know, and it's like, wow. It's not a matter of like, wait, what kind of bird is that, you know, or what was the temperature of that wind, you know. That's it.
I really like this conversation. It's a great topic. It's the thing I'm passionate about in life is that observation of our emotional state. And I love the science behind what you said. You know, the neurons that wire together. You know, like, what are we going to encourage in our being? And I think the other thing that's like the commentary. Like, I get a lot of commentary all the time, and commentary evokes emotion in me, and sometimes I'm able to let go of the commentary, and then there's nothing there. You know, like, sometimes emotion just comes up, like being here at Chikoji today, and just being in the Zendo and smelling the incense, I have incredible, like, feeling of sadness inside me right now, and it doesn't have a story with it, it's just a feeling, you know, if I just breathe into it, it's tight in the chest, and it's bittersweet, and it's just evocative of the smell of the incense, and I can tell you what the story is, but it isn't even about the story. So it's like my quest in life is just to observe what's going on inside of me, and then what's underneath that, and then what's underneath that, and what's underneath that. You know, usually I get to underneath it, and it's just like this tender spot inside of me that's just afraid of not being okay and not being accepted and not being loved or whatever. But there's all this layer of commentary on top of it that just gets in the way. So curiosity is just a wonderful way to explore that. And I mean, it's everywhere I go, everything that happens, there's opportunities to explore. There's work, there's friends, there's the dog, there's the garden. So it's endless, but I really appreciated that, you know, attitude of curiosity to let go of the commentary a little bit more and just feel the feelings in the body and just be with it all. So, thanks.
Thank you. Beautiful.
I like the word curiosity because it's so non-judgmental. It's not in approaching object or a person or your own state of mind. There's not a sense that default position is not there's something wrong with you. You know, there's the curiosity is just curiosity. It's see what it is about, or you know how I feel about it vis-a-vis this or that. So I really appreciate the curiosity element of myself and in others. So, thank you.
Thank you, Tinko.
You know, it seemed to me what you tended to kind of point towards was more the opportunity where I want to say uncomfort or pain or the suffering that you were going through and equating that to be the possibility of the deeper significance of curiosity and how that can in a sense redirect that, which makes me feel and sense or relate to the actual sitting, where I tend to come back to that a lot, where it's sometimes metaphorical emotions, for example, that are not per se. I mean, I guess they reside in my body, but when I'm sitting, for example, I'll sometimes go through incredible agony. And yet, by not moving, for example, and allowing this just unbearable uncomfort in my knees, or just burning, and rather than being reactive, being cultivating responsive, amazingly, it just somehow just evaporates. So a lot of it seems to reside in my relationship to it, which seemed like what you were kind of talking about. And as you said, and I've been finding this more often being said, that a lot of the reasons why people come here, as John said in his talk, was not because life is all great and rosy. There's something that's drawing you here, and you pointed at that quite eloquently. I don't know, I could probably talk more, but I think that's about all I need to say.
I am having an experience this weekend, which once again tests my curiosity as to what's going on. I have brought my middle daughter into the house and hosted her for the weekend. And I find that the way that works for me best in terms of finding out what is really going on with her is just to sit back and wait, and it comes to me. Now, when it comes to me, then I have to do something with it to stay comfortable. And one thing comes to me, I get comfortable, and then there's another one that follows right on it. And I don't know how you describe that, but the one thing that I do know is you all have taught me how to wait. You know? And when I arrived here some 8, 9, 10 weeks ago, I never realized that that was something that I was going to walk away with. But it is tested. And I think I'm reacting better, but I certainly have incorporated it in to the 40 minutes first and then the second 40 minutes, and I can gradually get to the point where selfishly I'm very comfortable. So, and I thank you all for that.
Joe, you mentioned the word decoupling evaluation from experience.
Mm-hmm.
Could you speak a little bit more about that actual activity of decoupling?
The more I sit, you know, I came in with a lot of grand ideas about, you know, what was going to happen, but that seems to be the constant work of it, is I have an experience, you know, I'm sitting, and then I evaluate it, then I think about it, that monologue, it's going, and what I'm trying to do in this whole Zen effort, you know, no effort thing, it's like, do this, but don't do this, and don't try to do it, and there's no goal around it, it's Zen, you know. But I go, hey, what I'm really getting at here is decoupling, it's just cutting that connection. And so the way it works out, I find that things are less painful. You know, I've learned from sitting like Kaga's talking that I can experience incredible agony. My first, you know, practice period where I walked in after sitting once in the morning, and then all of a sudden I was going to sit, what was it, 14 times a day for a month? I was in just unbelievable agony, you know. But I noticed that I could be sure, I could have this whole story that my knee was being torn, you know, I had a visualization of this red fire, these injuries that were going on, and that, but then the bell would ring, and I would stand up, and within 90 seconds, it was gone. The most unimaginable pain I've ever experienced was right there, and it wasn't real. You know, or it was real pain, I guess. I don't know, but it was
a real experience.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It happened. Yeah. 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 But once the story stopped, once I realized, once I quit defining what was happening and just looking at, like, wow, this is a more pain than I imagined existed in the world from just sitting, But it quit doing that. You know, the pain is still there. It's not a problem. How do
the same? You could apply the same thing to a pleasurable state as well as a painful state, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, because pleasurable states are like tying yourself to the back of a truck. You know? You don't know where you're going to wind up. It starts out like when we were kids, we had the skateboard and all that, and then you tow yourself to the back of a truck, but bad things happen. You know, you don't know where you're going to wind up when the truck goes around the corner, you know. So there, yeah, I would say you should decouple yourself from that truck. Just skate. Yeah, we learned that, you know. Yeah. Are there any kids here? But were you asking?
Well, it's interesting because, yeah. I mean, in a certain sense, we have minds that secrete thoughts. I mean, we're made to think.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, it's part of our repertoire to evaluate.
Yeah.
But so I'm wondering if the decoupling is not the decoupling of evaluation itself, but maybe, you know, holding on to that. Mm-hmm. Like the sutra we chanted, holding on to a fixed view or something.
Yeah.
I have that experience. Yeah, sometimes with the evaluation, but a little non-attachment to the evaluation, mm-hmm. because the evaluation might be a little different next time.
Yeah.
It's a kind of equanimity toward the evaluation, not an absence.
It's just an evaluation. Yeah. Not an answer. Yeah. Necessarily.
Yeah.
Decoupling is an interesting word.
I also wanted to ask a little bit along these lines where there's inner commentary or stories that I know not to put too much weight on, you know, let it go. But also I have also had the experience over the years that important information come to me and things that should be acted on. And Holly and I actually met in a workshop that was about communication and amazing insights or leads would come unannounced. And I have benefited in my life from acting more rather than holding back and just letting things pass. But so having curiosity about both. Mm-hmm. But sometimes I still don't really know which is which. How do I know if something's just not a inner commentary running along, and how do I know when it's life's teachings or do you know what I mean?
Yeah. If we could know that, we'd be done. I don't think there's any knowing. You know, one of the things I try to do, and I think it's what Michael's getting at is I came here originally looking for the truth, and I finally decided there is none. There's only different. There's no answers. So how do we know? Let's ask the teacher. What do you think, Michael? How do we know?
Don't know.
I have noticed that in posture, which that people tend to have kind of a leaning forward collapse posture or in upright, overly rigid upright posture. And so we've got to approach our practice coming at it from the right way. For some of us need to relax, other people need a little more energy and effort. So for you, the practice may focus more on action, whereas for Bill, it may focus more on letting go. But both things need to happen. And as far as how you know, I'd read something about a study about entrepreneurs that they don't most successful. The majority of really successful entrepreneurs don't really set goals. And they tend to evaluate ideas about what would happen if I failed, what would be the worst case. And if they can withstand that, then they'll go ahead and act. So that's the closest thing I've heard to how do we know.
Something else that you mentioned earlier, Joe, is that I think in that context you had a list of contacts and so on. The sense that the normal outcome of this decoupling or not holding to fixed views or so on is appropriate response, and the appropriate response could be to wait when it's time to wait or to act when it's time to act. You know, you will have a sense, your body and your mind will have a sense of the appropriate, what's appropriate, naturally, from this kind of decoupling or non-grasping of a fixed view or you know, being genuinely curious, which means being present, doesn't it? Being interested. Genuinely.
Generally, that's been my experience. Like life with Bill's saying is, when I give up knowing, when I give up and wanting to know or needing to know, suddenly something becomes obvious. And then what to do, it generally seems to be, how can I move through this situation and turn it in the smoothest way so that
spontaneous engagement will happen.
And it feels like skiing, where you don't have time to think, but you know there's bump, and you're going around that somehow. Is that?
I just want to add one thing. It's about waiting again. I wondered why this daughter, she seemed to be holding back on something, and I wondered what it was. And finally today, on an hour-long walk with her, I found out that she has a hormonal problem with part of her female anatomy. And I felt, as I thought about that, that's just another gift that came. Because now I understand and have a different view of some of her idiosyncrasies that used to kind of get me scratching the mirror, you know? And that was another gift, you know, which puts her in a whole different light, you know. And the wonderment is gone. You know, why does she behave like this, you know? So thank you for listening to my catharsis.
I really found it really interesting that the beginning meditators would close down their limbic system and the amygdala, and that the long-term expert meditators, they let it in, and they had this curiosity. And what I wanted to ask you was, in the studies, is there a part of the brain that gets enlivened in these long-term meditators that show the curiosity? Is there a curiosity part of the brain that shows up being enlivened in these long-term meditators? Is there something happening different?
Yeah. They are the insula is a primary area, and they're looking at patterns.
Insula?
Insula. Yeah, in patterns throughout the brain that they'll record people going through certain experiences, and then they can say, that's curiosity, that's sadness, this person's thinking thoughts. So the particular patterns that are lighting up can show curiosity. And when you get into the details, mainly what they're looking at is where sugar's going. So we're not actually looking at what the thoughts are, but how energy is being used, and we're learning to recognize systems of thought. And so they're noticing that the place in the brain where the words come from are not very active, and where emotions come from and where there's an open connection, those areas are active. It's fascinating. I try to minimize that because I can talk about that.
Language is above the right.
What's
the
that?
Language is above the left ear. Yeah. Right there. The right above the right ear is or association. But it's a frontal lobe too.
There's a researcher, I read some of his books, his name's Neil Slade.
Okay.
And he's done a lot of research on the amygdala.
Yeah.
And he actually teaches a method to what he calls tickle your amygdala. And we've tried that, and you feel this happiness for not any reason comes over you. Yeah. So it's a thing. He's a very interesting researcher, because I know you're into research.
Yeah.
You might look at Neil Slade, and he's particularly focuses on how to get the body out of shutting, you know, activating that amygdala in a negative way.
Sounds cool. Okay. In so the lunch bell is rung. The workshop, we'll have a workshop. I think we posted it. We're wondering whether it starts at 1:30 or 2:00, so probably count on 1:45. And we'll meet here. We still have room. And it's $25. So that's and we'll have lunch now and gather all by the table, and I will close with an invitation that all this science is rudimentary, and we will probably never know what's really going on in the human mind. But kind of a little knowledge, and then letting go of that knowledge, and just knowing it's possible. Our minds are like an art, and we can work with that as if it were, you know, we can always work with our minds as an art. So, thank you.